Misery is bad for business,
whatever the business. A man won't bet on it, and a man won't bet against it. And it has to be one or the other, you see, in our line of work. Do you see?
Yes, Anna said. I see.
He was driving her to Chinatown, where Ah Suk was waiting with his resin and his pipe.
Well, I've never had a girl murdered, and I've never had a girl beat, he said.
I know, she said.
So, you can trust me, he said.
Sun in Leo, in which Staines confides in Mannering to the extent that he admits regret in having entered into a sponsorship agreement with Mr. Francis Carver, explaining that the initial opinion that he, Staines, formed of Carver's character and history was and is grievously in error, his opinion now being that Carver is a villain of the first degree, and one not at all deserving of good fortune. To which Mannering, chuckling slightly, proposes a somewhat thrilling, because dastardly, solution.
"There's only one true crime upon a goldfield," said Mannering to Staines,
as they stamped through the undergrowth towards the southern edge of the Aurora claim.
"Don't you bother your head about murder or theft or treason. No, it's fraud that's the crime of crimes. Making sport of a digger's hopes, you see, and a digger's hopes are all he has. Digger fraud has two varieties. Salting a claim is the first. Crying a duffer is the second."
"Which is considered to be the more grievous?"
"Depends on what you call grievous," said Mannering, swiping away a vine. "Salt a claim and get caught. You might get murdered in your bed. Cry a duffer and get caught. You're liable to get lynched. Cold-blooded, hot-blooded. That's your choice."
Staines smiled. "Am I to do business with a cold-blooded man?"
"You can decide for yourself," said Mannering, throwing out his arm. "Here it is, the Aurora."
"Ah,"
said Staines, stopping also. They were both panting slightly from the walk.
"Well, very good."
They surveyed the land together. Staines perceived a Chinese man squatting some 30 yards distant, his panning dish loose in his hands.
"What's the opposite of a homeward bounder?" said Mannering presently. "A never-going homer? A stick-it to Mr. Carver?"
"Who's that?" said Staines.
"That's Quee," said Mannering. "He'll stay on."
Staines dropped his voice.
"Does he know?"
Mannering laughed.
"Does he know? What have I just told you? I'm not keen on getting murdered in me bed, thank you."
"He must think this a terribly poor enterprise."
"I haven't the first idea what that man thinks," said Mannering, scornfully.
Another kind of dawn, in which Ah Kui, placing his hands upon the armoured curve of Anna's bodice, makes a curious discovery, the full significance of which he will not appreciate until 8 days later, when the complete rotation of Anna's 4 muslin gowns has given him a mental estimation of the extent of the riches they contain, excluding, of course, the dust contained within the gown of orange silk, which Anna never wears to Canieri. Anna lay perfectly still, her eyes closed, as Ah Kui ran his hands over her gown. He tapped every part of her corset with his fingers. He traced each flounce. He picked up the weighted hem and poured the fabric through his hands. His methodical touch seemed to anchor her in time and space. She felt that it was imperative that he touched every part of the garment before he touched her, and this certainty filled her with a lucid, powerful calm. When he slid his arm beneath her shoulders to roll her over, she complied without a sound, bringing her limp hands up to her mouth like a baby, and turning her face towards his chest. Part 9. Mutable Earth. The 20th of September, 1865. 42 degrees, 43 minutes south, 170 degrees, 58 minutes east. Moon in Virgo, crescent, in which Ah Kui fills his firebox with charcoal, meaning to smelt the last of the dust excavated from Anna's gown, and to inscribe the smelted bars with the name of the gold mine to which he is indentured, the Aurora. And Anna, as she sleeps, mutters syllables of distress, and moves her hand to her cheek, as if intending to staunch a wound. When Anne awoke, it was morning. Ah Kui had moved her to the corner of his hut. He had placed a folded blanket beneath her cheek, and had covered her with a woolen cape, his own. She knew upon waking that she had been talking in her sleep, for she felt flushed and disturbed, and much too hot. Her hair was damp. Ah Kui had not yet noticed that she had woken. She lay still and watched him as he fussed over his breakfast and examined his fingernails, and nodded, and hummed, and bent to rake the coals. Sun in Virgo, in which Emery Staines, to whom Crosby Wells has since narrated the full story of his betrayal at the hands of Francis Carver, each having won the other's trust and loyalty, decides in a moment to falsify the quarterly report, removing all evidence of the bonanza from the goldfield records, and quite forgetting as he does so the determined worker Kui, who, according to protocol, and notwithstanding the circumstances of his indenture, is nevertheless deserving of a bonus. Emery Staines, arriving at the camp station, was surprised to see that the Aurora's box was flagged, meaning that a yield had been submitted. He requested the gold escort to unlock the box. Inside there was a neat lattice of smelted gold bars. Staines took one of the bars in his hand. "If I asked you to turn your back a moment," he said presently, "while I transferred the contents of this box elsewhere, what would be your price?" The escort thought a moment, running his fingers up and down the barrel of his rifle. "I'd do it for £20, he said. "Sterling, not pure."
"I'll give you 50, said Staines.
A partial eclipse of the sun, in which Emery Staines journeys to the Arahura Valley, sack in hand, with the intention of burying the bonanza, for a period of safekeeping, upon a portion of land set aside for Maori use, having not considered the possibility that Francis Carver might soon return to Hokitika to investigate why the Aurora gold mine, such a promising investment, has become a veritable duffer. In the flax at Staines' shoulder, a tui dipped its head and gave its rattling cry, sounding to his ear like a stick being dragged across pickets, while a reedy whistle played a tune. How wonderfully strange the sound. He stretched out his palm and touched the waxy blades of the flax, noting the vivid colours with pleasure. Purple at the blade's edges, melting to a whitish green in the very centre of the leaf. The tui beat away, and it was quiet. Staines reached down and took up the smelted bars. He laid them carefully.